He's a tough man. To let him live is taking a chance.
Since he knows our secret, he has to be killed.
Terry Segori, 6'6" of half-breed fury. But he's got a little problem. He has a hard time making friends.
You tell that bitch who sent you here how sorry I am I can no longer be her friend.
Alma, you don't know where I can find an apartment, do you?
Why, sure, Joe. How about the King's Arms?
King's Arms? Where's the King's Arms?
Around the Queen's ass.
Here comes Crump! Here comes Crump! Here comes Crump!
Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 32. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we'll be looking at some Asian action films from the 60s and 70s. I'll just let Sally do the intro and then we'll get stuck into it.
Paleo Cinema is a three-weekly podcast that looks at film noir, horror, cult movies, classic films, science fiction and other genre works from 1895 to 1980. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U @gmail.com. So please send comments, feedback and MP3 voicemails to that address. The blog for the podcast, which has lots of extra content relating to each episode and a chat window where you can interact with other listeners, is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. This podcast contains adult content and occasional swearing, so don't lend your MP3 player to children.
Okay, let's get into it. How are things going? It's winter here in Melbourne. It's pretty crummy. The weather's got less than I want it to be. I'm going to whinge about it for a while, blah, blah, blah. But apart from that, not too much happening. This time of year, people tend to batten down the hatches, occasionally go out to dinner and not do much else. I did get some feedback from the last podcast. I got a lot of tweets and a few comments on Facebook, but I did get an email from the very person I did the last podcast for, my old mate Danny Oz. So I'll just read that letter and then I'll get into this week's basket full of wonderfulness. Okay, it starts out, "G'day Terry. Well, it's taken me a while to get around to writing about the Kids Safe movie podcast I requested, but rest assured on the day I was refreshing the site every hour or two waiting for it. Well, what can I say? I asked for it and I knew you wouldn't pick anything unimaginative or twee. You didn't disappoint. A great range of films. I already owned or was intending to buy a few of them before the podcast as it was, and now I have a couple more to track down. I'm not sure if I mentioned it to you that it was the podcast where you had talked about The Thief of Baghdad with Sabu where I thought I should ask you for a children's film podcast. I was always intending on showing Lex, this Danny's son, a broad range of stuff with a good smattering of black and white films and TV shows in there, so asking for more suggestions made sense. While I class myself as a film buff, the amount of time I seem to have to watch movies is always limited. In recent years, I tend to want to be wide awake when I watch a classic film for the first time. And since Lex came along, finding four uninterrupted hours where I was wide awake to watch things like Fritz Lang's first Dr. Mabuse film is virtually impossible. Maybe I'll just have to down a can of V one night and do a catch-up. V's an energy drink, if you don't know. I don't know if they have it overseas. There's also a bunch of popular films in recent years that I've missed in the cinema because I didn't think they were worth cinema prices. Of course, when it comes to renting them on DVD, I have to remember them, and let's face it, a lot of cinema is forgettable. Anyway, I'm a bit tired and rambling. I'm driving down to Melbourne tonight so I can go to Trivia Night and have a bunch of Paleo Cinema to listen to. So looking forward to that. By the way, have you thought about doing a Paleo Cinema panel at Continuum 5 or a panel on podcasting? I think you should. Thanks for that, Danny. Continuum 5 is a science fiction convention here in Melbourne later this year. I might just pop in briefly to do a panel, so I'll have to talk to the organisers for that. But if people want me to do a podcasting panel there, absolutely, I'll advertise it a bit on the podcast itself. So anybody who's in the region can pop around, have a chat, shoot the shit, and have a good time with it. So Yeah, apart from that, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I mean, that was the whole idea of the KidSafe podcast, was to get out there the things I thought were interesting and maybe go outside the envelope a little bit. I did get some feedback as well saying that maybe something like The Magnificent Seven was less KidSafe than I thought, because there was a mention of Yul Brynner saying that they might rape all the women in the village. So, yeah, I'll take that on board, but I think maybe a reference like that might go past some kiddies. But I do take that on, and I may do another KidSafe podcast in the future, and if so, I'll try to vet out those little inconsistencies that maybe make some of the movies a little less KidSafe than I had thought they were. Yeah, I did enjoy putting together the KidSafe podcast. Let me kind of go back and look at a few things. Maybe next time I'll look at old TV shows that I think are KidSafe. So children's shows as well as shows for adults from the paleo cinema era that I think people would like and wouldn't mind showing their kids. And if they did show them to their kids, their wife wouldn't disapprove. So that's on the back burner for next time. Well, not next time, but for a future podcast. What else have I watched lately? I did see Dreams with Sharp Teeth, which was a documentary about Harlan Ellison. If you can find a copy of it, recommend it. Good doco of Harlan. Really enjoyed it. It was done a little bit in the style of The Kids' Days in the Picture, the documentary about Robert Evans. So it's got some of the same camera tricks that were used to bling up some of the black and white photography and black and white photos in the documentary, just to illustrate the narrative. But yeah, a good documentary, not world beating, but very engaging. And Harlan Ellison, being the kind of saintly sinner that he is, comes across very well. There are people like Robin Williams in it talking about Harlan, and Neil Gaiman, and a number of other interesting characters as well. So recommend that one. I did finally get a copy of a movie that I've liked for a very many years. It's not a big film. It's not a particularly well-known film, but I've got a certain fondness for it. It's a film called Banning, starring Robert Wagner, Jill St. John. Gene Hackman's in it as well. Who else? James Ferrantino's in it. Dean Stockwell's brother Guy is in it. And basically it's a bit of a soapy about a guy working in a golf course. So it's one of the great golfing movies, along, of course, with Caddyshack. And I kind of like it because I like the 1960s rich person sleaze ambience of it. I like the fact that they've got just about everybody who could be in a film like this. There's a character actor called Mike Kellen who plays a gangster called Kaliel, and he's just tearing up the scenery with that. If you get a chance to see Banning, it's well worth a view. It's not, as I said, not a particularly big film, not a particularly good film, but it's a film for which I have an unreasonable and inexplicable fondness. The other thing I saw that was interesting and retro and harked back to my misspent childhood was I found an episode of Sea Hunt with Lloyd Bridges on the web. I wasn't able to find any episodes anywhere else, but I watched an episode of Sea Hunt with Lloyd Bridges, and I like the way that they use a lot of voiceover, because it's a bit hard to have a character do a lot of dialogue while he's got a rubber tube in his mouth. So that was interesting. You know, it kind of gave me a nice nostalgic buzz, and enjoyed it a lot. But we better get on with the movies for today. Okay, this time around I'm looking at three different Japanese crime, gangster, action film types. The first is the Sonny Chiba Street Fighter series from 1974 to 1976. The second is the Hanzo the Razor series. And the third is a couple of movies by that most gonzo stylist in 1960s Yakuza Japanese movies, Seijin Suzuki. I'll go back into a bit of my history with Japanese media, just to give you a background of where I'm coming from on this. My first exposure to Japanese media culture came through a few glimpses of 1940s American war movies on TV, where Japanese people were seen as evil apes. And I remember seeing one movie where they showed the bayoneting of a baby done in silhouette by some studio, anxious to show us how monstrous the Japanese were at the time. Of course, the evil bastards were all played by Chinese actors, a practice which is still going on in movies like Memoirs of a Geisha. There was that meme implanted that Japanese people were evil. But the early 1960s, things were changing. Japan was making cheap animation and weird and wonderful live TV shows, which were being dubbed into English by small American companies looking to sell an inexpensive product to domestic and foreign markets. Now, I'm sure someone got wealthy off this, probably because the dubbing was cheap and dodgy. Cartoons like Astro Boy, Prince Planet, Princess Knight, Kimber the White Lion, and Tobor the Eighth Man went viral amongst my friends. You just couldn't get away from them. Everybody talked about them at school.
There's a prehistoric monster who came from outer space, created by the Martians to destroy the human race. The FBI is helpless, it's 20 stories tall. What can we do? Who can we call? Call Tobor the Eighth Man.
So along with all these really cool animation things, there were some live action shows that were happening in Australian television. They were being shown on Australian TV. There were shows like the live action programs like The Samurai, where Shintaro the Samurai and his sidekick, a ninja called Tombei the Mist, fought evil ninjas in medieval Japan. And modern times spy secret agent kind of show called Phantom Agents that was about kind of like modern day ninjas fighting bad guys in Japan. They were immensely popular. Now, I remember my grandfather complained about my obsession with ninjas and star knives at the time, and I can sort of understand why. 20-odd years before, Japanese people were shooting at him and piloting mini-subs into Sydney Harbour to torpedo ferries. So here we are a couple of decades later, and I was pulling my eyelids sideways and pretending to jump backwards off shed roofs and pretend gutting my little brother with a samurai sword made from a willow branch. So, yeah, I can understand why he had some issues with that sort of thing. But it kind of prepared me to accept the kind of worldviews you see in Japanese action films. I'd grown up with them in a sense. And so when I saw a movie called Street Fighter for the first time in the 70s, and even things like a lot of Jimmy Wong Yu's Chinese martial arts films, I was kind of geared towards the grammar of Asian action films in a way that a lot of other people maybe weren't. Street Fighter, I'll talk about the Street Fighter, four movies really in Street Fighter series first. Three of them are actually Street Fighter movies. The fourth one, Sister Street Fighter, has Sonny Chiba in it but playing a different character. So I'll give you a brief précis of the first of the Street Fighter movies, play a little audio from it, and then talk about it for a while.
The Street Fighter. If you've got to fight, fight dirty.
I'll kill Tsuruki. Now I owe it to him.
You're the meanest guy in the world.
You'd better give up. I'm a master and you're going to lose this game. I've waited a long time to settle the score. Don't be too impatient. I'll see you another time.
Okay, everybody knows Sonny Chiba. Sonny Chiba played the sword maker in Kill Bill. And yes, I will mention David Carradine later. And he had a long and illustrious career in Japanese cinema dating back to the 1960s. But it was in about 1974 when he really hit the big time, playing Terry Suguri or Tsurugi, depending on which dubbed-in voice you listen to on one of the Street Fighter movies, who is a half-breed Chinese-Japanese mercenary, in a sense. He's probably got to get this out of the way. Japanese action heroes can only be described one way. They are total bastards. No two ways about it. They will do things you will not see any Western movie protagonist do. They will enjoy doing them, and they will fuck up a lot of people while they're doing it. So, having said that, I'm going to go into a bit of the plot line of Street Fighter and then tell you why I like it so much. Here's the plot line from Wikipedia. Terry Tsurugi, Sonny Chiba, is a martial arts master for hire who comes to the rescue of a kidnapped heiress. The film begins with Tsurugi meeting the condemned murderer Tateki Shikambaru while disguised as a Buddhist monk. Suguri applies his oxygen coma punch to Tateki, causing him to collapse just before he can be executed by the jail. As Tateki is rushed to the hospital, Tsurugi and his sidekick Ratface — it's actually called Rakuda, but in the English dubbing it's called Ratface, and for fairly obvious reasons — ambush the ambulance and free him. Later, Satiki's brother Gijon and his sister Nachi arrive and plead for more time to pay for Tsurugi's help. Outraged, Tsurugi refuses and attacks the siblings. Gijon falls to his death and Nachi is sold into sexual slavery. So the hero of this movie sells a woman into sexual slavery for welching on a deal. A group of gangsters attempt to hire Tsurugi to kidnap Sarai, the daughter of a recently deceased oil tycoon. Tsurugi refuses after discovering that the gangsters are Yakuza. He escapes, but the Yakuza gangsters resolve to kill Tsurugi as well as kidnap Sarai. Tsurugi immediately seeks out Sarai, who is being protected at the Seibun Karate Dojo by Kendo Masaoka, a karate master. Tsurugi captures Sarai and challenges the entire dojo to a fight. He brutalizes the rank and file students before Masaoka bests him. Ultimately, Tsurugi offers to protect Sarai and Masaoka agrees against Sarai's protests. Meanwhile, the Yakuza allies in Hong Kong recruit Tateki to avenge his siblings by killing Tsurugi. The gangsters make several attempts to kill Tsurugi before they successfully kidnap Sarai. Tsurugi manages to rescue her and gets captured himself. Ratface gives up Sarai's location to save Tsurugi, causing the Honorable Tsurugi to forsake him. Basically, he ditches his sidekick. Tsurugi finally tracks the gangsters down to a shipyard and fights his way through their guards. In the end, the Hong Kong crime lords permit Tsurugi to duel with Tateki. Nachi sacrifices herself to give her brother a free shot with a sigh, but Tsurugi survives and kills Tateki. Critically wounded, he stumbles to his feet, and the film ends abruptly in a freeze frame. So that's basically it. It's lots of blood, guts, gore, nastiness, and some really, really good stuff in the karate dojo where they show you a karate move and then there's a subtitle underneath telling you what it is. So that's quite fun to watch too. And there are some hardcore karate people in this movie, including Sonny Chiba, who was himself and probably still is a hell of a karate expert. And he's got an incredible presence in this movie. He's fantastically vivid. He pulls faces that are not unreminiscent of a Maori doing a haka. He looks dead, feral, and nasty. He's got bushy eyebrows, he's unshaven, he's unkempt, and he's probably one of the nastiest protagonists in any action film anywhere. This movie was made by Toei Studios and decided to release its own martial arts films after Enter the Dragon hit the big time. And they cast Sonny Chiba, who had been well known in Japan for a while, having starred in many successful action comedy and drama films, as well as numerous TV shows. So it's extremely violent and graphic in its violence. There's a scene where Tsurugi castrates a rapist with his bare hands. So you don't see that in too many films. You're not really going to see that in an action film starring Shia LaBeouf. Not going to happen. You're not going to see him rip the dick off a black man while he's just attempting to rape a woman. So the Street Fighter had two sequels, Return of the Street Fighter, which is pretty kick-ass too, and The Street Fighter's Last Revenge, which is an interesting film because Tsurugi is much more sophisticated and much better groomed in Street Fighter's Last Revenge. It's almost a James Bondy kind of role in a weird way with lots of karate stuff in it and a lot more nudity than the other two films, so never a bad thing. I mean, if you're going to have a violent action film set in the 1970s with that twang-twang music, a little bit of nudity kind of goes in well with that. It's like having a little bit of hollandaise on your poached egg. So there were all these movies, including Sister Street Fighter, which is, yeah, it's pretty good. It's a pretty good action film, but it's not really up to the first three. All of them are public domain. You can get them incredibly cheaply on Amazon. So they're like something like $8 US on Amazon. You can click through on the website, by the way. So I'll get about, you know, 3 cents out of that. So if you want to get a copy of them, click through on paleo-cinema.com and give me 3 cents towards it. But they are incredibly, incredibly cheap to pick up. I believe there are some download sites where you can get them as well. And they're good action films. You're not going to expect anything quite to the standard of Bruce Lee, but they've got a certain wild, interesting world built into the movies where Tsurugi is the hardest, baddest bastard in a world that's full of Okinawan karate champions and little Rang guys who run karate dojos and can beat just about anything on two legs, and beautiful women who get sold into sexual slavery in some cases. But it's an incredibly wild and violent environment in the films. You never see any cops unless they're getting beaten up by somebody. and it's a kind of anarchic Japanese world, and because in this case I think dubbing works because it's dubbed, you don't have to read the subtitles, so it kind of brings you into the world in a different way. I don't normally recommend subtitles, but I think for this sort of an action film, like dubbing, but for this sort of an action film, the dubbing works well. You don't expect the dialogue to be fantastic. I mean, it's not going to be Harold Pinter. It really does work in the case of the Street Fighter films. For value for money, you can't really go past these films. They're just fantastic fun. They're incredibly violent, incredibly crazy, and if I ran a cafe or a nightclub, I would have the big plasma screens showing Street Fighter movies up on the wall. I wouldn't get sued for it because they're public domain, they're wild and crazy, and they bring a certain ambience with them. And Sonny Chiba is an incredibly vivid character. You've got to like him, and you get part of his charisma in Kill Bill, playing the swordsman, where he's got his tongue very much in his cheek. But in these ones, he is severely nasty and, you know, kick-ass thug. And I think over the course of the three films, he does mellow without losing any of his edge, which is nice. I mean, you do get some action heroes that soften over time with a series of movies. But this isn't the case with Street Fighter films. Quentin Tarantino really loves these films, and they were an influence on a lot of his work, predominantly Kill Bill, of course. But I can understand why. And of course, in the movie that he wrote the script for, True Romance, there's some dialogue by Christian Slater about Sonny Chiba movies. I think he takes someone on a date to a Sonny Chiba movie. I haven't seen the movie in a long time, so can't recall the details. But definitely worth checking out and having in your collection. If you don't pick them up, it's pocket change, really, and good value for that. So in a moment, I'm going to talk about the second lot of Japanese action films, the Hanzo the Razor series, and I'll be back in just a moment. Okay, Hanzo the Razor. Now, Hanzo the Razor is a fictional character featured in a trilogy of Japanese Jidaigeki films of the same name. The film stars Shintaro Katsu, best known for his role as Zatoichi, the blind swordsman, which was later made into a movie starring our old mate Takeshi Kitano, otherwise known as Beat Takeshi. And after the very successful series of Zatoichi movies where he played a blind masseur who was also a kick-ass swordsman, and there's actually a reference to Zatoichi in the first Street Fighter movie where Tsurugi goes up against a blind swordsman. So it's a little bit of a nod towards the Zatoichi there. Basically, it's Dirty Harry set in pre-Western influenced Japan. So it's in 18th, 19th century Japan. The character of Hanzo the Razor is a policeman. He's a police inspector in some senses. And the movie starts out with him basically dressing down his superiors for sucking up to various interests in the palace and among the rich merchant classes and not treating everybody equally under the law. There was an oath he needed to sign and swear to that was asked of him as a police inspector, and he refused to do so because it was a dishonorable thing to do. Hanzo isn't, you know, a big, handsome-looking guy. He's kind of slightly chubby, large and beefy, and not the prettiest human being in the world, but he gets the job done. He's got a cohort of reformed criminals who he has reformed mostly by beating the shit out of them, who help him with various adventures and exploits that that Hanzo finds himself in. Now, this is a sick and twisted character. I am not kidding you at all. I'm going to tell you about it, and please don't think I'm making this up, because it's absolutely true, and it's in all the movies, and you can see it for yourself. I'll read this off Wikipedia just to make sure that I am getting everything right. Hanzo vilifies elitism and corruption, consistently railing against the powers that be, who continue to threaten him with harakiri for his insolence. He continuously mocks his superior officer, Megabe Onishi, whom Hanzo dubs Snake Megabe, due to Onishi's penchant for bribes and beautiful women. He's a constable who normally carries a short two-pronged dagger, a jute, rather than a sword. This jute has a hidden weighted chain within it, which Hanzo uses to block against sword attacks or ensnare fleeing criminals. He uses torture. Now, I'm not talking Dick Cheney waterboarding here. He tortures himself so he knows what it feels like, and he has significant scars over his body because of this self-inflicted torture. And he tortures other people as a means of interrogation. He ritually flagellates his huge penis so as to make it stronger. This exercise is always followed up by him practicing sexual intercourse on a bale of rice. So basically, he beats his dick with a truncheon to make it tougher and harder. He's even got a board to lay it on, which has the indentation of a large dick in it. And he whacks it with a stick, basically, to harden it. And he turns it into a weapon in a weird kind of way. Now, Hanzo's home is filled with exotic traps and weapons to defeat assassins. He's got a hidden hall of weapons near his Japanese bath, and a whole bunch of metal spears that descend from the ceiling when he hits a certain place on the wall so he can skewer attackers when they come down the hall at him. Here's a bit that's politically incorrect and wrong on a number of levels. Hanzo interrogates female suspects by raping them. Later on, he drinks sake with them in his Japanese bath, and they immediately become infatuated with him, primarily due to his sexual prowess. Apart from the physical nature of the attacks that Hanzo does, he's not entirely different from the Sean Connery James Bond. Connery's Bond seduces women as an interrogation technique, and they become infatuated with him because of his sexual prowess. Hanzo takes a more hands-on approach to this. And while I'm not disrespecting women and I'm not condoning this kind of cinema, it's a weird thing to watch. And if you can step aside from your own preconceptions and accept the fact that this is an outrageous piece of cinema from a politically incorrect era and a politically incorrect star and director, then you kind of got to go with it. With these kind of things which border on Japanese pink films, you just got to accept them on their own level without getting out the political correctness police. If you don't like this sort of film, fantastic. I understand that. I respect that. I'm not saying anybody should watch this sort of film where there is a moment or two of sexual violence by the protagonist. But this is part of what it is. And the more outrageous thing for me is to watch a guy beating his dick with a truncheon on a slab of wood. Not sure why. Maybe it's a personal thing. But I think the way the sexual scenes are done is not to titillate. I think it's just basically to show that Hanzo will do anything to uphold the law. So I think there's a difference between this kind of sexual violence as, I'm not sure how to phrase it, as an outrageous cartoonish thing, as opposed to sexual violence in a number of other films I've seen of various types where the intention is to titillate and the intention is to turn people on and the intention is to humiliate. I mean, I'm not that fond of Salo. I've seen it a couple of times. But there are aspects to that that I'm uncomfortable with much more than I am with the stuff in Hanzo the Razor. And I didn't mention this, but I should have. Hanzo the Razor is actually based on a manga, so it's a comic book protagonist in a feature film. So a lot of the events that happen have that kind of magnified craziness to them that a lot of Japanese manga has. But let me know what you think of that kind of approach in Japanese film. It'd probably be good to open a dialogue on it. I'm not condoning it, but it is a part of the film, and I find so much else that's interesting in the films that I can excuse that in this particular case. The star of the Hanzo movies, Shintaro Katsu, is an interesting character as well. I'll just get some information I've got on him. He had a lot of problems later in life with drugs and sexual scandals and all sorts of things. As I said, in the 60s and 70s, he played Zatoichi in 25 movies between 1962 and 1973. He starred and directed in a 26th one in 1989 and played the role in four seasons of a spin-off television series. So basically, he was Zatoichi longer than Columbo was Columbo. But he was a heavy drinker, and he had several skirmishes with the law regarding drug use as well, including marijuana, opium and cocaine arrests in 1978, 1990 and 1992. These incidents resulted in him being removed from consideration for several parts, both in Japan and abroad. So basically, he was a bad boy. Like Sonny Chiba, he had that kind of over-the-top presence as an actor. In Zatoichi, of course, it was underplayed, but in Hanzo the Razor, he was like, he's just like a tough, gruff, take no shit. Any way he can to get the crime solved, he will do it. So there's not a lot to say about the Hanzo the Razor series, apart from the fact that Katsu's brother, Tomisaburo Wayakama, was the guy who starred in the Lone Wolf and Cub movies. So looks like a family business. They were kind of like the Baldwins or the Sheen Esteveses of their time. The movies are available out there, and they are crazy. I mean, you can always fast forward through the bits that you may find offensive and still get a lot from the film. The most of the violence is kind of over the top and comic, but there are little bits of business, and the set designs and the period style, the feel for a time when Western people weren't given a glimpse into Japanese culture is pretty interesting. So that's about it for Hanzo the Razor. On to Seijin Suzuki's Brand to Kill and Tokyo Drifter. A few years ago, my friend Jamie said to me, you've got to watch this film that I got. I picked it up cheaply. It's a Japanese gangster film called Branded to Kill, and it is fucking weird. So, you know, he lent it to me, and I watched it, and yes, it was seriously fucking weird. But I will talk about that film second, because chronologically it comes after the first film. I'm going to speak about Tokyo Drifter. Basically, the story of Tokyo Drifter is pretty simple, but the movie is not really about the story in that sense. I'll get the IMDb synopsis. In Tokyo, a gangster Tetsu reforms when his Yakuza boss Kurata decides to quit his criminal life. However, the mobster family led by Otsuka threatens Kurata's legitimate business, and Tetsu decides to leave Kurata to relieve the pressure on him. He leaves his girlfriend Chiharu and becomes a drifter moving to the country. When Tetsu is betrayed, he returns to Tokyo and resolves the situation. That's basically it. It's kind of like a Ronin movie, you know, like a masterless samurai, except it's set in 1960s Japan and on a fairly limited budget. Now, Seijin Suzuki was a thorn in the side of the studio that he worked for. Between 1956 and 1967, he made 40 B-movies, pretty much, for a film company in Japan called Nikatsu. And increasingly, he was experimenting with style and different ways of telling a story. I mean, you're making 40 movies in, what, an 11-year period. You're going to fiddle around with it a little bit to keep yourself interested. And that's exactly what Suzuki did. He was getting, with Tokyo Drifter and most of all in Branded to Kill, he was taking the stylistic elements of the Yakuza movie and running with it full tilt towards a wall. He was Tokyo Drifter, he experimented with vivid colours and some really unusual location shots. The budget wasn't large, so he had to use his imagination. The studio said, well, you know, Suzuki's going crazy. He's making all these weird films that we don't understand. So we're going to cut his budget down in order to discipline him and to get him back on track with making the kinds of films that we want to make. Of course, And Nakatsu was absolutely wrong. What this did was made Suzuki and the people he gathered around him as collaborators more intent on exploring ways they could tell the story in vivid and interesting ways on what was becoming an increasingly small budget. And he did so. He spent a lot of... There are a number of different sets in the film, but there are a lot more location shots. So they went out and shot a lot of things out in the countryside, in the snow. They shot some bits of it in train yards. They just basically used any place where they could, using a vivid colour process and an extremely wide screen, just create wonderful looking compositions and action sequences of a style that hadn't been seen before. And particularly in Tokyo Drifter, that's exactly what they did. A Seiji and Suzuki movie is never less than visually interesting. You can have the sound off, you can have the subtitles off, and it's still incredibly vivid and interesting. Yeah, it's there's nothing like them anywhere. And the melancholy music that he uses in both films, you've heard a bit of it in the previous clip I played from Tokyo Drifter, but he does a very atonal kind of jazz soundtrack for Branded the Killer as well, which helps to carry the mood that the cinematography is doing out. The Katsu bosses really tried to rein Suzuki in and had no luck at all. So they took Suzuki and his art director, Takeo Kimura, basically went nuts with the surrealism and absurdity bits. It's, without giving it away, it's a bit hard to describe, but there is absolutely nothing predictable in a Seiji and Suzuki Yakuza film. It has an incredible vividness. The characters tend to be at best melancholy, but very, very good at what they do. The Yakuza gangsters they have in this are almost superhuman in their adaptability and in their ability to know what's going to happen and deal with it. It's crazy, this film. And this, more than any other film, I think, this film, Tokyo Drifter, was the major visual influence on all of the Japanese scenes in Kill Bill Part 1. There are sets that look the same as the ones used in Kill Bill. There are colour palettes that are the same. There's an incredible homage to Tokyo Drifter all through those sequences in this film, in the film of Kill Bill Part 1. Watching, it doesn't detract from watching Tokyo Drifter or even watching Kill Bill if you know Tokyo Drifter, but I think it's it shows how Tarantino is fantastic at doing mashups of other works and making them his own by adapting them. It's not in any way plagiarism, but I don't think he has to do that. But the stylistic and the emotional influences of Tokyo Drifter on a film like Kill Bill are blatantly obvious to anybody who's seen both films. The music carries it through. The theme song that I played a bit of there is played in various contexts throughout the film, and given that the budget was low, it has an incredibly rich and vivid and interesting, well, not story to tell, but mood. More than anything, it's the mood and the ambience, and the locations in particular are fantastic in this film, and not the usual things you see in even a standard Yakuza-type film from Japan. Suzuki and his people worked extra hard to turn the small budget into a plus rather than a minus. They used it as a way of prodding them on to being more creative. So if you haven't seen Tokyo Drift, there are parts where it lags a little bit. It does drag on a little bit long, but visually and stylistically, it's a film to blow you away. It really, there's nothing quite like it in cinema. And rightly, Suzuki is now being recognized for this. See it. It's if you have to rent it on Netflix or whatever your local video rental by mail company is, definitely do so. It's incredibly fun and worth seeing. And if you're a lover of cinema, and you are, it should be part of your collection or at least of your memories of cinema. In a moment, I'll talk about Branded to Kill.
ある組織の幹部だ 250万 あとは契約を履行した時その音が渡す。殺し屋ナンバー3にランクされている君の腕次第だ。
恐ろしい男よ、私のハツ。
As weird as Tokyo Drifter was, Branded to Kill is even weirder. After Tokyo Drifter, Nikatsu, the studio, were really pissed off with Seijun Suzuki. So they cut his budgets again and told him he was doing the next film in black and white. So, of course, Suzuki saw that as a challenge again. And he made Branded to Kill, a black and white widescreen, totally fucking crazy Yakuza film. It's like nothing else. Okay, I'll give you a bit of a plot line. Goro Hanada, the Japanese underworld's third-ranking hitman, and his wife Mami, fly to Tokyo and are met by Kasuga, a former ranked hitman turned taxi driver. Kasuga petitions Haneda to assist him in breaking back into the profession. Haneda agrees. The three go to a club owned by the Yakuza boss, Michihiko Yabuhara. Two men are hired to escort a client from Tsugumi Beach, Nagano. After the meeting, Yabuhara covertly seduces Haneda's wife. Haneda and Kasuga pick up a car designated for the job and unexpectedly has a corpse in the back seat. They dispose of the body, then meet the client and proceed towards the destination. En route, Haneda spots an ambush. He dispatches a number of gunmen while Kasuga panics and flails about in hysterics. Foaming at the mouth, Kasuga charges an ambush at Ko, the fourth-ranked hitman, and they kill each other. Haneda leaves the client to secure Ko's car, but hears three gunshots and rushes back to find the client is safe and three additional ambushes have been shot cleanly through the forehead. At a second ambush, Haneda kills more gunmen and sets Sakura, the second-ranking hitman, on fire. Sakura madly rushes toward the client, but he's shot dead by him. Now, this is a great scene, this one, because the guy must run 200 or 300 meters while on fire. It's crazy. Now, I won't go into it, but that's just the first 10 minutes of the film. Haneda is a sick puppy as well. Another sick puppy in a long line of sick puppies in Japanese action films. He has a fetish for sniffing boiled rice. It's like Viagra for this guy. He'll sit around the rice cooker, sniffing the rice, and then go and nail his wife. The plotline is that nobody knows who the first-ranking hitman in the Japanese underworld is, but part of the plot is finding that out. Now, Haneda, being a hitman, does all sorts of really interesting hits. He snipes at the first person he needs to kill from behind an animatronic cigarette lighter in a billboard. So when the cigarette lighter snaps open, he shoots the guy. Second guy, he shoots from a basement up through a drain pipe when the guy leans over the sink. So that's pretty cool too. And the third one goes wrong and he accidentally kills an innocent person because a butterfly lands on the barrel of his rifle, causing him to miss. There are all these weird motifs that go through Branded to Kill, one of which is butterflies, another one of which is dead birds. A woman whom Haneda becomes obsessed with, Misako. When he first sees her, there's a dead bird with a pin through its neck sticking from the rearview mirror of the Volkswagen she's driving. You see more of that in the film. It's an incredibly weirdly stylized film. There's a lot of nudity in it. Haneda's wife, Mami, tends to walk around the house naked, which is not a bad thing. A very attractive woman. Bit of eye candy there. Haneda goes to Misako's apartment and she promises to let him make love to her if he kills her. I won't go into the rest of the plot because describing the plot in this film just gets weirder and weirder. All I can say is that widescreen black and white looks fantastic. The film's incredibly stylized. The action sequences, because Suzuki had 40 films under his belt, mostly action films, he really knew how to put one of these together, and they are different than anything you'll see anywhere else. They are crazy, gonzo. The locations are fantastic, and I believe some of them may have had an influence on some of the scenes in a film like Get Carter, the original Michael Caine version of Get Carter. has some stylistic similarities in some of the scenes to Seijin Suzuki's Branded to Kill. Yeah, it's hard to describe these films in any meaningful way unless it was a video podcast and I could show you stylistically what it means. I mean, for some people find Japanese cinema inaccessible. They have trouble reading subtitles. They don't get some of the cultural context. And I'm not pretending for a moment that I get all of the cultural contexts of any of the films I've talked about today. I think there's enough interesting things in an action genre that even if you miss nuances and miss certain cultural bits and pieces in a film, there's still so much you can take out of it that makes watching the film a fulfilling experience. It's a bit like somebody watching an Australian film. You don't need to know about tram conductors to watch Album Purple. You don't need to know where locations are. You don't need to know various bits and pieces to watch an Australian film. You can still get enjoyment out of it not because of the differences, but because of the similarities between cultures. And I think that's what it comes down to. Even if you don't get the full context of a film coming from a widely divergent culture, you can understand because there's that thematic link of humanity running through it in common with the things with which you're familiar. And, of course, the more films from a particular culture you watch, the more of these nuances you'll pick up and the more little bits of business will have meaning for you. So it's an education process, I suppose. And I think a gateway drug for this are action films. You can understand them on the purely action level. That may spark an interest in finding out a little more about the cinema of a particular country. So maybe that's a rule. If you want to understand the cinema of a country, first look at their action films and work inwards from there. Let me know what you think about that too. It's just off the top of my head, but I can definitely see there's some validity to that. Not too much else I'm going to speak about there. I will now go on to speak about David Carradine. Now, the first, as you all know, he had died either of murder in a Thai hotel room or by autoerotic asphyxiation, much in the same way that an excess pop star Michael Hutchence did, and Albert Dekker, the actor who played Dr. Cyclops, did. Not my kind of thing, autoerotic strangulation, if indeed that's what Carradine died of. But, yeah, whatever floats your boat. The first movie with an R rating in Australia, which was 18 years and above, oversaw, was Boxcar Bertha, starring David Carradine, directed by Martin Scorsese. And I had seen Carradine in a lot of things before, including, of course, Kung Fu. He was very big on that. I was a little pissed off that he didn't get an Asian actor. I was very much into the early cinema of Bruce Lee, and not having an Asian actor playing an Asian character seemed to me a bit silly. But David Carradine carried it off. He had a certain gravitas and a zen manner about him that kind of worked with the role within the constraints, of course, of 1970s American television. He was also good in films like Cue the Winged Serpent, fantastic as a detective in that, a small-budget Larry Cohen movie about a giant winged serpent living in the Chrysler Building in New York, which is a fantastic little film with some interesting stop-motion animation in it. He was in Serpent's Egg for Ingmar Bergman, but the big roles kind of eluded him because he did have a fondness for alcohol and various kinds of drugs, so he kind of drifted into the B, C, D, and Z movie range, but never less than an interesting actor. And of course, he was Bill in Kill Bill. Quentin Tarantino did one of those career revival shots that he did for other people, including Robert Forster and Pam Grier, and even Lawrence Tierney in Reservoir Dogs. So, yeah, I mean, he'll be missed, and I think he's a part of 1970s, in particular, pop culture for films like Death Race and Death Sports and of course, the TV series Kung Fu. So, mostly, it is unfortunate that people will more than his work remember the way he died, which is often the case in these circumstances, and it's an unfortunate fact of him. But just give me a moment and I'll wrap up and I'll have a guest star.
Okay, I've got Sal here just to say hi briefly and finish off the podcast with me. So how you doing, Sal?
I'm fine, thank you.
Okay, so tell me three old films that you like apart from Wizard of Oz.
Oh, they have to be pre-1980, don't they?
They have to be pre-1980.
Does it count that I was like only seven in 1980?
No.
Six, actually.
No.
Well, how am I supposed to know old movies?
No, to be honest with you, I was watching 2 Weeks in Another Town this afternoon. you walked in and said, oh, you're watching 2 weeks in another town. So you're getting to know old films in spite of yourself, aren't you?
That's your fault and I hate you.
Is that right? Why do you hate me for that?
I'd just like to clarify, if I may, the true reason I'm actually here at the end of this podcast today.
What would that be?
And that is because Terry knows he's in the poop for the last couple of podcasts and Facebook, where he's had nothing nice to say about his long-suffering missus over here.
Is that right?
Yes. Oh. 2 years with you is like 50 with anyone else.
You've been with me for 8 years, though.
I've been only married for two, so I was giving you that 6 years off.
Fair enough, okay. Yeah, so apart from Wizard of Oz, what old movies do you like? Let's get back to unreality. Yeah.
I just wanted to put that claimer in there.
Okay, well, I'll put that in there.
And I was meant to be on the children podcast, but I admit I cracked the poops at that one.
You did a little bit, but that's it. Okay, I'm going to do another children's one at some stage. And
you won't let me do Wizard of Oz.
Yes, I will.
It's only a good children's movie.
Just because I said that Dorothy was a whiny little twat.
That could be the reason I refuse to be part of your podcast.
Oh, okay. No, well, I'm entitled to have my opinion.
It's even if it's wrong.
No, it's not wrong. It's just mine.
Well, I'm trying to think. Pre-1980s. No, yeah. Twilight Zone movie is 83, so I can't count that one.
Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
I haven't seen it.
Haven't you?
Never seen
Mary
it.
Mary Poppins.
Seen that.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it recently.
No.
But it's all right. Dick Van Dyke and his really bad English
Cockney
accent.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of the great bad Cockney accents of the world.
Yes. I'm trying to think what else. I've been watching mostly my Don't Fall in Your Paleo Cinema things, but what? My bad CGI creature features.
Yeah, Sal's got this passion for really bad CGI monster movies, mostly by the Sci-Fi Channel, but from other places as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you're really into those, aren't you?
Yeah, and they always have really cool titles like Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus.
Yeah, which is pretty self-descriptive, isn't it? Everything in the movie is there. Yeah, and what was the other one?
Pterodactyl.
Cleavage Field. There was.
I haven't watched Monster yet, but I will.
Yeah, we'll have to watch
a
Cloverfield ripoff at some stage. But that's your passion in cinema, isn't it? Really,
it is. So I'm just trying to. I'm still trying to think here in the background of any. I haven't actually watched any old things. I'm very sorry.
You watch some old TV occasionally.
I've watched The Twilight Zone, but don't ask me to remember all of that.
Yeah, I mean, five seasons of it, you went mad with that, didn't you?
I do. I tend to sit down and watch it in a marathon session, and then I don't remember any of them.
Yeah, because just you snippets. Fall asleep halfway through, yeah.
I do. I do remember a couple with Burgess Meredith that were good. The one, don't ask me the titles of them, but the one where he was going to be executed in the room. Mm-hmm. With the bomb, and he manages to trap the people in there with him. Am I giving away the plot, or is there no limit on...
I think spoilers are okay after 40, 50 years.
Oh, okay. I just want to make sure.
Yeah, and there's the other one where he broke his glasses.
Yes. All the time I want and all the time I need.
They had some fantastic actors in those.
Oh, and the doll one. My name is Talkie Tina.
Okay, yep.
And I'm going to kill you.
Yeah, but that kind of thing. So that's your kind of stuff, isn't it? Yeah.
They were good.
But there's fantastic actors in them. I mean, you got Robert Duvall. Yeah, you got Shatner in it, but you got Lee Marvin.
Hey, what's wrong with Shatner?
Shatner
pre-Star Trek, Shatner's pretty good.
Yeah, I know that, but in Star Trek, they must have, like, beamed up half of his brain and like the rest of it or something, because he kind of went a bit
because he was stylized even better that. Actors, and he had to...
Yeah, well, that's it. There is a good YouTube video at the moment where Maurice LaMarche, who did the voice of Brain in Pinky and the Brain, is driving along the Los Angeles freeway. And he's teaching the guy he's in the car with how to do a Shatner impersonation.
Mm-hmm.
So he's telling him where to pause and how to do weird inflections and things like that. I'll see if I can put a link on the website to it, because it's quite interesting having a masterclass in how to do William Shatner while a guy's driving along the freeway.
And I think we should also start a campaign for Talk Like a Shatner Day.
I think that was what it was part of.
Oh,
Talk Like William Shatner Day.
Is there really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
If people want to see it, I'll put a link onto the blog, but there is going to be an international Talk Like William Shatner Day. I think it's in March on his birthday or something.
That would be cool.
So, yeah, you're going to get a lot of people with weird pauses when they speak.
Really?
No, that's not right. That was not right. That was not a good choice, yeah. But, yeah, there will be.
See, you put me down again.
No, I didn't. You did.
So. Better phrase would have been, nice effort, darling, but not quite right.
But that would be a lie. But, yeah, International Talk Like William Shatner Day. Maybe we should look at the early cinema of William Shatner on the podcast around Talk Like William Shatner Day. I'll try to remember to do that. If I don't, everyone forgive me.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's about it this time around for Paleo Cinema. So you're going to say goodbye to everyone?
Goodbye, everyone.
And also goodbye to everybody. Enjoy your movie watching and send us some emails, some voicemails, some MP3s, some DVDs you don't want, anything you like. And I'll be back in 3 weeks with I Don't Know What. Thank you.